Please welcome SDPA's Conference Medical Director and Assistant Professor of Dermatology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dr. Arash Mostaghimi.
All right. Thank you very much. Good to see you guys here today. What a fantastic talk by Dr. Mostaghimi. I will be the second of three alopecia talks in a row. And it's lovely to have everybody here. So let's get started. Usually I say these disclosures don't matter, but these disclosures actually are very relevant to what I'm talking about today because I do a lot of work in alopecia, particularly alopecia areata, which I'll be talking about. And the real disclosure is not these companies that I work with, but the real disclosure is that my interest in alopecia comes from my experience as a father. So this is my daughter, Layla, when she was 7 years old. At age 5, Layla lost all her hair. So Layla has alopecia universalis. She's doing great now. She's about to turn remarkably 14, and she has a lot more hair than she does in this photo. But although I've taken care of these patients for a long, long time, I'm embarrassed to say it wasn't until I had this own experience in my own life where I truly got it. You know, there's a difference between the concept and understanding the concept of the challenges of folks dealing with hair loss versus experiencing it either directly or vicariously through your daughter as a parent. So I'm going to go through a few different things that we can do. You know, the real challenging cases, treating challenging cases in alopecia, Dr. Mostaghimi, we just went through some amazing cases, right? Some remarkable cases of patients with scarring alopecia, difficult types of alopecia to treat. Those are really challenging cases. I'm going to talk to a few things that are newer that you can use across all cases of alopecia sometimes or in specific cases. So one thing that we've done recently is we are rediscovering the old, which is minoxidil. Who saw this article in the New York Times? Whose patients started asking about this article in the New York Times? Okay, a bunch of you out there. So an old medicine grows new hair for pennies a day. If your patients were asking you about it, you weren't the only one. This is a paper that said, what is the sum of first-time oral minoxidil prescriptions? And you can see right after that paper came out, it quadrupled, right? It went from 0.25 to about 1 where it settled out. Really showing you the impact of media in terms of educating people and letting them know this drug is like 50 years old, you know, and it's fairly cheap. So who here has prescribed oral minoxidil in the last little bit? Okay, a lot of you, okay. Who here in the last year was the first time you prescribed oral minoxidil? Okay, so a lot of you are new here, wonderful. So oral minoxidil, we're very used to topical minoxidil. Oral minoxidil is basically the same medication, right, in an oral formulation. And the real question we have is two things. Is it safe and does it work? Okay, and those are two things that we're going to talk about today. So minoxidil, just to give you a history of it, many of you are probably familiar, minoxidil is an old drug that was used for blood pressure. It was used for some cardiac arrhythmias. It was used in some people that had heart failure. The dosing there is like 40, 60, 80 milligrams. The dosing that we talk about for hair loss is, as Dr. Mostaghimi was saying, around 1.25 to 2.5 for women and 2.5 to 5 for men. Those are the ballpark. You can go a little bit higher, a little bit lower. And so a lot of the data that you see for minoxidil comes first from, like the safety data comes from the 40, 60 milligram dose, so it doesn't really apply here. And secondly, a lot of the side effect data you see also doesn't fit. So we have to reconsider these things. But before we say how healthy is it or how safe is it to use, let's talk about does it work? So this is a really neat type of study, this relative efficacy of minoxidil and 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. This is called a network meta-analysis. And what a network meta-analysis is a very sort of fancy statistical way where you can take data from all different types of studies and then combine it so you can do head-to-head comparisons between the different treatments. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of this right now. So this result, let me see, can I get a... All right, look at that. I can get this a little bit on the side here. So what you see here, is this is on the left, you see the list of all these different medications, 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, so dutasteride and finasteride, and then you have split in it different doses of minoxidil, different percentages of minoxidil. And the higher the number, the more green it is, it means relative to the other ones in that group, how well did it work, okay? And each column is a different outcome because these are all different studies. not each drug was studied at every time point, and not each drug was studied with the same endpoints in mind. So I want to pull your guys' attention. Let's see here. Well, I'll pull you guys' attention. Let me describe it with words. You guys can see it. So the third row is minoxidil 5%, and you can see that's 80.4 in column A and 54.6 in column B. Column B is looking at terminal hair regrowth at 24 weeks. If you look at E, so you look all the way down with like 5 from the bottom, you see minoxidil oral, and you see in that column B 99.9. So that shows you that that 99.9 suggests that it works about twice as well as topical 5% minoxidil. If you look about where the finasteride oral 1 milligram, a couple of rows below the topical minoxidil, you see a number 84.4. So the oral minoxidil will work better than 1 milligram finasteride and will work better than the topical minoxidil. So that's really the space of high dose oral minoxidil, high dose among the low doses, right? So 5 is a higher dose for the low dose oral minoxidil. And it shows you that it works better than the other lower concentrations certainly as well. The nice part about this is that this is an artificial choice, right? In real life, we don't have to choose between finasteride and minoxidil. These are two drugs that you can use commonly together. So there's a lot of room for mixing and matching treatments, particularly ones that work in different mechanisms. I want to take your attention to the top left, that dutasteride 0.5 milligrams. Who here is familiar with dutasteride? You guys heard about this drug? So a few of you have. Dutasteride is a cousin of finasteride. It's a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, and instead of it, the mechanics of it are very different. Finasteride you take on a daily basis, and it works for about a day. It works for about 24 hours. Dutasteride you also take on a daily basis, but one dose basically works for a week. So it's much more continuous 5-alpha reductase inhibition. So it's used for prostate issues, much like finasteride is, and has also made its way over to hair. The data is really, 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 really limited. That's why they only have data not even for terminal hair, but for all hair at 24 weeks, which is why it's only in one of those columns. Over time, we may find that it's a suitable and appropriate trade versus that it works better than finasteride. The one question that we have is, okay, well, what's the main side effect of finasteride, right? Sexual dysfunction in men. Dutasteride likely has a worse sexual function side effect because it's more potent inhibition. So the real question is, what is the appropriate trade-off and what are we willing to give up for additional hair growth? Additional studies are required. Okay, so low-dose oral minoxidil works. Is it safe, right? So again, you have to have these conversations with your patients because if they go talk to a pharmacist and the pharmacist is not familiar, they'll talk to them about cardiac arrhythmias. They'll talk to them about pericardial inflammation. They'll talk to them about hypotension. These are all real things that occur with minoxidil, but they occur with minoxidil at 60 milligrams. If you're giving somebody 2.5 milligrams, the question is the safety the same? Is it different? How do we think about this? So this is a big study. It's not a perfect study. It's a retrospective study, so it's not the highest level of evidence, but it's our best evidence to date across multiple centers. And I'm going to walk you through this, the demographics of this trial, and then the actual results. So the mean age is 37-year-old men, 47-year-old women, and the average dose 2.5 for men, max of 15. So they went much higher than I think most of us would do in this room. And for women, 1.1 with max of 12.5. So in the US, most of what we do is 2.5 to 5 again for men, 1.25 to 2.5 for women. You can always go up a little bit. And this shows you that the patients are kind of match the demographics of what we're used to. And overall, I'll give you the bottom line first. Only about 1.7% of patients stop due to side effects. So that means that 98% of patients tolerated this medication and continued it on that basis. So I'm going to walk you through this. Let's start at the top. So it starts off with 1,400 patients. You can see 80% had no adverse effect whatsoever. About 1 in 5, 20% did. That's the bottom column there. But of those adverse effects, 15% of them were hypertrichosis. So this is having too much hair. It's having hair in places that you don't want it. So it particularly affects women, where you say, okay, I have now chin hairs. I have hair on my face. I have other hair that I don't particularly want. That's an easy thing to do. You can adjust the dose and move on. About 5%, so 1 out of 20 patients had lightheadedness, fluid retention, something else that was going on in that context. This is a little bit challenging because we can't really see what dose they were on, and some patients were on much higher doses. And you look at the column on the right, of the patients with adverse effects, you know, almost all of them were continued after a dose adjustment, and then only 1.7% overall, 43 out of the 1,400, required withdrawal, and the majority of that, a third of those, were from hypertrichosis or having too much hair, right? So that's not a very significant side effect. There are legitimate other side effects there, fluid retention, tachycardia, lightheadedness, but again, none of the cardiac-specific side effects that we see, no pericardial inflammation, none of those stuff, none of those types of things. There's only one reported case of pericardial inflammation from minoxidil in the literature, at the low doses that we're talking about. The other thing that's helpful here is if you look at the bottom, you see the tachycardia, the high heart rate, right, is a fast effect in the first 24 hours, lightheadedness in the next week after that. I think generally if you work your way through that, the body will adjust. Headache, which is not something that I've personally seen, it's only reported in, you know, a handful, 0.4% of the people in the study, occurred about at the 3-week point, and then the fluid retention came on after that. But I think for most patients, if you can get them past the first week or two, and tell them that their body's going to adjust to the medication, they do quite well. In my mind, I think about this a little bit like spironolactone, where because it has some cardiovascular effects, in spironolactone's case, a diuretic effect, in this case, a blood pressure, et cetera, effect, it does take the body a bit of time to acclimate, even with the low doses. So together, I think we can look at this and say, okay, oral minoxidil works, and oral minoxidil is likely safe, right, for most of our patients. But the best part overall may be the cost. This is a 90-day prescription that on GoodRx. So it's practically free as far as medications are concerned, right, for drugs in the United States. And the real nice part is that you pay for it out of pocket, right? You don't have to go through insurance. There's no need for prior authorization, none of those types of things. And it's very easy to give people 90, 180 days at a time that they can use. So overall, I think that the utility of this medication, if the medication is efficacious, if its safety profile is good and its cost is good, the nice part about minoxidil is that it can be a primary treatment or a secondary treatment in almost all types of hair loss. So Dr. Montejemu spoke in the last session about scarring alopecias. So scarring alopecias, the way that she was describing it was the way that I was taught, that it's a one-way ticket. And once you have a scarring alopecia, once your hair is lost, you can't get it back. Well, that's not entirely true. You can grow back some of the hair, but the other thing that you can do is to thicken and extend the life of the hair that you have. So the minoxidil can optimize the existing hair that you have. So using this as an adjunct, certainly topically, as she described, but orally, if your patients will tolerate it, is fantastic, right? So you can imagine if I'm missing hair in one part of my scalp, if I can really thicken and grow hair in other parts of my scalp as well, it'll help me cover up the areas of hair loss. So it has a good camouflage effect in that regard. So that's for scarring alopecias. We're going to talk about it coming up for alopecia areata. And then it can also certainly be used in this primary course as in the androgenetic alopecias, both for men and for women. I find that men very excited to take this. Basically, you can say that, look, it looks like finasteride. Most men that have any concerns about finasteride have sexual side effect concerns. I love, it tells me a lot about men. You're like, you know, you take this drug, you may not be able to get an erection. They're like, doc, I'm really concerned about that. You're like, you take this drug, your heart may stop. They're like, that's cool. Bring it on. We can do it. So, you know, the side effect profiles of this is something that most men are amenable to. And as I said, you can combine the two together as well. So these should really be in your frontline treatments. I encourage you to use it if you haven't used it already. It can be first line in almost anything. It can really be an adjunct agent for almost any other treatment that you're doing. Oh, I want to say one last word about for women with minoxidil. Their main concern is really facial hair growth. I find that the people that I have most difficulty with on the medication are not actually people that have already some facial hair growth. So not not patients with, let's say, a Mediterranean origin or Middle Eastern patients, in patients from India that naturally have a little bit more likely to have facial hair. Those folks have already figured out how to manage that or deal with that or don't care about that. The people that actually seem to be most impacted by this are patients that maybe have never had facial hair but are really worried about it. And what I encourage them to, I say, let's try it. If it grows, if you grow hair, first of all, they often will realize the hair on their face first. And they come back at that time, I say, that's good news. If you're growing hair in your face, it means you're growing hair other places as well. But once they identify that that the treatment is working for them, they can either manage the facial hair, which is pretty easy to do, or that they can dose reduce, and a lot of times they're very satisfied with the overall treatment. So work a little bit on your script, work a little bit with those negotiations, and you may find that you have a lot more success in getting that through. All right. So what's new in alopecia areata? So alopecia areata, I found, is a fascinating disease, not just from my personal experience, but I think it's a little bit like alopecia areata used to be a little bit like eczema was. So I don't know how long many of you have been practicing, but before biologics came for eczema, these were your most challenging patients, right? They would come in, you didn't really can make them better, you couldn't really do much. You put them on a variety of medications that may or may not work that well. They're really frustrating patients to take care of. They're actually a little bit like our hidradenitis patients today. Alopecia is definitely like this too. Your heart sank when you saw an alopecia areata patient because we were very limited in our arsenal. Well, fortunately, that is changing, and I hope it also changes for other diseases moving forward. So we have actually, for the first time, a better understanding of the epidemiology of alopecia areata, and it looks like it's probably pretty similar to psoriasis, as a matter of fact. So the prevalence of this is about 0.2 to 0.5%. Moderate to severe prevalence is relatively high because once you lose that much, and a moderate to severe means 50% more hair loss. Once you lose that much hair, you're not having the spontaneous improvement and resolution that you sometimes see with more mild cases. The lifetime incidence is 1 to 2%, and it occurs at all ages. We always think about kids and young folks. There's a complete spike of folks that I think we often underestimate or don't see later in life. These are patients who are in their 60s, in their 70s. And as I'm going to talk about in a moment, it looks like the antigenic target, right? So your body, your immune system is attacking your hair follicles in this case. What is it attacking? It looks like it's attacking pigmented hair. And maybe the pigment or a protein associated with the pigment in the hair. So I think a lot of folks who have hair thinning and loss when they're older and go suddenly gray, I think what you're really seeing is that they're getting alopecia areata of just the pigmented hair, and they're retaining some of their white hairs in that context. So it may be that there's actually more people out there than we think. It's also the kind of thing that often when people get this disease, they realize that, oh, they may have had it previously in their lives, but they kind of ignored it, thought the barber did something or something along those lines. So let me walk you through a little bit of the pathophysiology here. This slide, I just like PTSD for those of us who aren't as excited about pathways, right? But on the left here, you have the hair follicle bulge, and that's showing you that all this inflammation is going on right at the bulb of the hair. This, I think, is like the number one issue with alopecia areata. First, we always have these debates or discussions with insurance, is alopecia areata cosmetic or not? It's because you can't see the inflammation, right? If the scalp was red, I think we would completely think differently about alopecia areata, but the inflammation is deeper. So that means two things. First, you don't see it, and then secondly, the treatments that you're providing, they have to penetrate deep and down into the hair follicle to get that treatment, right? So a lot of our topical treatments don't really work because they don't get down deep enough to where the action is. So the key here, you can see over here, is this interferon part here. I'm going to highlight this over on this side as well. I'm going to start talking over here. And so what happens is that once this cell, the bottom cell is the immune cell, and once it attacks the hair follicle, it releases this interferon. This interferon will bind to the cell that it's attacking. It will cause it, it will go through a pathway called the JAK-STAT pathway, which we're going to talk about in a minute. Go to the nucleus of that cell, change transcription, and then release different cytokines. So you can see IL-15 on this side, IL-15 on this side over here. That comes back and it makes the immune cell work even harder, right? So you have this crazy cycle that once it identifies a target, the immune cell itself is releasing interferons. That is upregulating inflammation in the hair follicle itself, and that comes back to tell the immune cell to work even harder. So you have this cycle until the hair is lost, and then the inflammation stays there and keeps the hair from coming back. So the key to treatment of this disease is to break this cycle, right? To break this immune cycle that's happening. So as I said, the major problem we have for this drug is that there's not really safe, effective, and consistent drug delivery. That's why we're really reduced to doing injections. which is really the only great treatment that we have for patients that have limited disease. So a patient come in with very limited disease, your options are to do nothing, right? So about 50% of patients will spontaneously revert with, you know, one or two spots. You're thinking right now, that's not what I see, but probably it's because by the time they see you, those 50% either never see you or they would have gotten better, right? Those are your no-shows with alopecia in your clinic. But once you've had it for about 4 to 6 months, it likely needs treatment to get better, and our first line is the injectable steroids. I want to push back a little bit against topical therapies. About a third of these patients get topical therapies. There might be a role for topical therapies in children, where the skin is thinner and the absorption is better. I think a little bit of this, and I'm not blaming anybody, that we're just giving people something to do while they're waiting and hoping that the hair comes back. If you look at it, I don't think that the spontaneous resolution rates for topical treatment are any different than the natural history. And whenever we give people steroids, topical steroids, the reason we give them is that they're not penetrating deep. That's the whole point, right? That's why they don't have the side effects of oral steroids. So we can't have our, have our cake and eat it too. We can't say, okay, this is awesome because it doesn't penetrate, and oh, it's going to work even though it has to penetrate in order to get there. So I would really question the use of topical steroids as and its utility in these patients. Now, for extensive disease, we have some historical options, right? We have anti-metabolites. We have prednisone. Anti-metabolites are like methotrexate, azathioprine. These are medications that don't work very well. They probably work in 25 to 30% of patients. They will work alongside of prednisone. So there's a recently published article in JAMA Dermatology, methotrexate by itself, not so hot, methotrexate plus prednisone, a little bit better. Who wants to put people on long-term prednisone? It's not really an exciting idea. There is a role for some biologic agents, particularly in patients that have an overlap of atopic dermatitis and alopecia areata. That's about 25% of people with alopecia areata. Those patients may really respond to Dupixent, to dupilumab. It's unclear the exact pathway, but it seems that the IL-4 blockage, so we think about the IL-13 pathway, seems to be more important in eczema, but the IL-4 part of that process of dupilumab may be what is driving some of the alopecia areata in those patients that have that overlap. So particularly for your young patients or particularly patients that have a significant diathesis of atopic dermatitis, I would strongly consider considering this drug as a first-line agent, even in light of the data from JAK inhibitors that I'm going to give you. The reason is twofold. First, in my experience, the patients often do very, very well, okay? And secondly, if they do well, the known safety profile and long-term data for dupilumab is fantastic, right? So you can be on that drug for an extended period of time. You know what to predict. You're not worried about laboratory evaluation. You're not worried about future oncological risk. So if it works, it's fantastic. And if they have atopic dermatitis, their atopic dermatitis will get better as well. The newest thing on the block are JAK inhibitors. I'm going to go through a lot of data for baricitinib, a little bit of data for ritlecitinib, and then deruxolitinib doesn't have very much public data, but that's hopefully going to be coming out next year. And we'll talk about their role. They are a huge, major step in the treatment of patients with alopecia areata. I want to say one more thing about atopic dermatitis. When I mean atopic dermatitis, I'm not meaning the patient you typically put on Dupixent that is like littered with eczema. I would extend the definition of atopic dermatitis to, I had atopic dermatitis when I was a kid and I grew out of it, think about that person. I have significant allergies, hay fever, asthma, think about that person as well. I have just a little bit, you know, a couple times of the year, think about that person as well. So anybody that has a touch of eczema, really think about that for dupilumab for those patients. There really is some exciting data for that. So the net result is that this is prior to the introduction of JAK therapy, so a JAK inhibitor. So although we have all this stuff, here you see about 63% of patients said they're very unsatisfied, right? And then about 35 of them were taking, are going to alternative therapies, right? This is a survey that we did of the National Alopecia Areata Foundation membership. So the reason that people are going for alternative therapies is the same driver that they're unsatisfied. When things are not working, you try whatever can happen. And I'm hoping that as we get better therapeutics, this percentage goes way down. So I've previewed this a couple of times, but let's talk a little bit about JAK inhibitors, okay? So what I'm about to show you for JAK inhibitors, I'm going to connect it to alopecia areata, but for those of you that are seeing JAK inhibitors across a range of different conditions, right? Psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, maybe hidradenitis, all these different things where JAK inhibitors are being used, they all kind of work the same way. So this is a general way that you can think about it. So there's four members of the Janus kinase family, the JAK family. These are JAK 1, 2, 3, and TYK2. Okay, they're discovered out of order. They didn't realize TYK2 was a JAK inhibitor, so that's why it has a different name. But it's important to know that all of these are JAK inhibitors. And what happens is that there's a process that you get activation of this intracellular transmission. So on the top here is like the outside of the cell, and the bottom is the inside of the cell. So something activates a receptor, and then it triggers the downstream pathway that leads to inflammation in the body. So here you have a cytokine, right? It's coming, it attaches to the cytokine receptor. It couples that receptor together, and it leads to phosphorylation of these different kinases that then come together, dissociate, dimerize, and then go into the cell and cause a bunch of inflammation, okay? This is a gross simplification, but this is the general sort of normal JAK-STAT pathway. It's also important to note that we're talking about this. We talk about this in terms of diseases, right? And inflammation and all these, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, all this sort of stuff. This same process is actually really important in your bone marrow and how you make blood. This JAK-STAT is expressed everywhere. It's expressed in the liver, it's expressed in the colon, it's expressed in all different types of places. So it's a fairly ubiquitous pathway. So what happens with JAK inhibitors is that they will bind to this receptor, and they don't allow the free-floating JAK to bind to the receptor, get phosphorylated, and then to dimerize and cause that downstream inflammation. So basically, you don't get the activation, you don't get the phosphorylations, there's no docking, and you don't have that move into the nucleus. And so all of the subsequent pro-inflammatory effects that the JAK-STAT pathway will cause is blocked. Okay, so that's in a nutshell what these do. So this is super different, right? This is super different than the extremely highly targeted biologics that we talk about. For a decade, right, two decades, people have been coming up to us and saying, look, this IL-17 biologic for psoriasis is incredibly precise and only binds IL-17. It blocks this one part of the pathway. The IL-23 inhibitor blocks one part of the pathway, right? And leaves the rest of the immune system intact. This is not that. This is broad. This is much closer intellectually to prednisone, which impacts a whole range of different conditions, right, of different inflammatory pathways, than it is to guselkumab, secukinumab, all the other drugs that we can mention, okay? So in your mind, from an efficacy profile, you need to think about this or how it works. Think about this closer to prednisone than a biologic. Biologic works for one drug, one disease, right? So if you give dupilumab to a patient with psoriasis, they're not going to do well. It's not going to work because those are targeting really different pathways. Those are really different pathways. You're targeting the wrong pathway. You give prednisone to anybody, they're going to work, okay? They'll help. The reason we don't use it has a terrible side effect profile. So JAK inhibitors block multiple different pathways, as we're going to talk about in a moment, and they impact, so they can be used for a lot of different diseases. That's why you're hearing about them across a lot of different diseases. So take a look at this. On the top left, you can see these different JAK1, JAK2, JAK3, and TYK, and how they're expressed in these different pathways. And you can see on the top left, you have interleukins 2, 4, 7, 15. On the right, you're going to have your type 2 cytokine receptors, you're more your psoriasis ones, the interferons, the IL-12, 23. And you can see that depending on which JAK you're blocking, you're going to hit a different ratio of these receptors. So that's why there's some differences between if somebody says, I'm a JAK1 specific molecule versus a JAK1-2 versus a JAK3, there are some biochemical variation as to what you'll block and the downstream impact of it. So when I say TNF-alpha inhibitors, there's going to, much to the chagrin of some of my pharma colleagues, you can think about them all kind of the same, right? When I say IL-17 inhibitors, you can think about those drugs in a bucket. You can think about IL-23 inhibitors in a bucket. When I say JAK inhibitors, you can't think about them in a bucket, okay? You have to train yourself to say, what drug am I thinking about? What pathway you can think about, but the drugs that I'm going to talk about specifically, the exact drug is important. So just because you know something about one JAK inhibitor doesn't mean you can apply it to another. So just, we have to be careful about the heuristics we use. So splitting this same data up slightly differently, you can see, okay, well, here are the different diseases. Alopecia areata, psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, vitiligo, alopecia areata, psoriasis, and these are the different inflammatory markers. And you can see, okay, well, selective JAK3 inhibitors on the far left might be good for alopecia areata and psoriasis. JAK1 inhibitors, these are like upadacitinib, abrocitinib. These are drugs that you can see for across many of these, right? Alopecia areata, psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, they're currently approved for atopic dermatitis. And then you see the TYK2 inhibitors, these are deucravacitinib, looks like it's more covering the psoriasis pathway. And then at the very bottom, you have non-selective JAK inhibitors, which block multiple JAKs. And what they can do is they can impact multiple of these different diseases. The challenge is that even when something is labeled, let's say JAK1 specific or JAK1/2 inhibitor, they're not as clean and perfect as biologics in the way that we think about them. So a JAK1 inhibitor also does a little bit of JAK2, also does a little bit of JAK3. It's not purely clean, right? So everybody's gonna have a different story for why their JAK inhibitor is more precise or more specific or has less potential for side effects, but you have to really look at the individual data for each drug to understand how it works in real life, in vivo. So I spent a good amount of time talking about baricitinib. So the reason I'm gonna present a lot of data on baricitinib is that baricitinib has now been out for about a year, and there's a lot of data from the prior clinical trials and from the, and its clinical use. And it's a good way, I think, of thinking about the potential for JAK inhibitors in alopecia areata. So for baricitinib, what you see is you have a JAK1/2, this is the same kind of cartoon that I showed you before. And on the left side, you can see where baricitinib blocks that JAK1/2 pathway, blocks that impacts of that interferon, and then therefore reduces the amount of IL-15 coming. If there is some IL-15 coming, it also blocks it, so it works on both the inflammatory cell and it works on the hair cell as well, and really reduces this cycle. So I'm gonna cut to the final data first, and I'm gonna say that this drug works, okay? This is these are two trials that are the same, but basically they're showing you the SALT score at 36 weeks. So SALT score is percentage of hair loss on the scalp. 100% SALT means that you have no hair, you're totally bald. 0% means that you have all of your hair. In these trials, they included people that had over 50% hair loss. SALT 50 or above was required for inclusion. And your most current episode had to be less than 8 years. So you couldn't have been bald. You could have alopecia for longer, but you couldn't have had this be totally bald for more than 8 years. And their outcome is at 36 weeks, and they're showing SALT score of less than 20, okay? So they're saying about a third of people at the higher dose, a fifth of people at the lower dose, ended up growing back hair such that they had less than 20% hair loss. Now, this includes people that went from 50% hair loss to less than 20. This is not as far as a journey. It includes some people that went from 100% hair loss to less than 20. Less than 20 is good, but it's not awesome, right? If you're still missing, like, show me the 20% of hair on your scalp you'd be willing to lose and be like, I'm cool with this, right? But it's a reasonable proxy for generally how these patients are going to be doing. The first thing to think about in this is what is the safety outcomes for baricitinib? Well, I find this interesting that it increases acne. We have a paper that will be coming out soon looking at acne across JAK inhibitors. We don't know why people get it. We don't even know if it's real acne or not. It's some inflammation, some follicular inflammation, not just on the face, but on the scalp and the neck that you can get with JAK inhibitors. You can usually treat through it. You treat it like acne, topical clindamycin, topical retinoids. Sometimes you can dose reduce, and it gets better. More commonly seen in JAK1 inhibitors. Upadacitinib seems to have the highest rate, abrocitinib, followed by that, and less than other ones, but everybody can see it. And then you have these lab markers, elevated creatine kinase and elevated cholesterol, that seem to have no consequence in terms of patient safety. There's not rhabdomyolysis reported, there's not pancreatitis reported, there's no cardiac effects reported, none of that stuff is recorded. The other thing that was not identified in this trial is venous thromboembolism or cardiovascular risk. I'm gonna talk about that in a moment. So, now that we've moved, that was the global data, right? Can I ask who in this room has prescribed baricitinib for alopecia areata? So a few of you. Okay. So baricitinib, as I said, 40% success rate, 38% success rate at 36 weeks is not that great, right? But that doesn't tell the whole story of this drug. This drug works really, really differently in different people, and I think this analysis really helps identify that. So on the left, you have a third of people that nothing happens to them. They don't get better at all, okay? In the second box, you have early responders. Look at these guys at 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 16 weeks. They're growing hair like it's unbelievable, like a weed, right? That by 24 weeks, you know, they have 80% of them have grown back almost all, you know, less than SALT 20, right? In the third box, you have the gradual responders. These are people that slow. And then the most remarkable group to me is this group in the fourth box, which is glacial, okay? Not just slow, but the slowest thing you've ever experienced, right? If I met you and I say, look, you've been dealing with alopecia areata for many years. I know this is really troubling to you. They'll start you on a medication. For these patients, you have to counsel that you're going to have to wait maybe up to a year to make a decision as to whether or not this drug is really working for you or not. A year is a really, really long time. Think about where you were a year ago today. Think about how much has gone down between now and then, right? So you may get lucky, maybe in this early response group or this gradual response group, but the challenge is here, if you're, you know, at week 24 and grown 4% of your hair, 4% of your hair is this much, and then 12 weeks later, you're still growing this much of your hair, and this much of your hair, like 4% of people have grown rather 20% of their hair. Most of people are growing small amounts of their hair. If you have just small, doc, I'm not better, it's not getting that much better, you may be surprised that maybe people that come quite late. We don't have any way up front of differentiating which bucket you're going to be in. That would be awesome, but we don't have that. The second thing that we don't know is this is not real life, right? In real life, we would add usually something on. These patients are not getting injections, they're not getting minoxidil, topically or orally, they're not getting prednisone, they're not having any other things. So it may be that we can both improve the curve or, you know, push people along faster, right? Or give people more complete responses if we add those adjuvant medications, but we don't know that from this medication alone. Part of what comes in is that the duration of hair loss matters. So as I said, your current duration of being bald had to be less than 8 years in this study, but maybe your first time you had alopecia could have been however long ago. So if you're treating somebody and they say, oh, the first time I got alopecia was when I was 20, now they're 40 years old, that means they've had a 20-year duration of alopecia areata, they're going to be in this the column on the right, and the group on the right, where they have lower and slower response rates. If they say, I've had alopecia areata for 5 years, or my hair just fell out 2 years ago and now I'm totally bald, these are patients that you're more excited to treat, they're more likely to respond, they're more likely to do well. And this, I think, we don't understand exactly why. It probably has something similar to do with Dr. Madhijan was talking about in the last lecture, where she was saying sometimes chronic non-scarring alopecia, like alopecia areata, can end up having more impact over time. As we said, some people take their time. So this is a different way of looking at the same data. This data starts at week 52. These are people who have already been on it for a year. So in the baricitinib trial, if you didn't grow back your hair by a year, you were kicked out of the study. The only difference was there's a group of people, if you grew back eyebrows and eyelashes, even if you didn't grow scalp hair, they would keep you in the study. So this is a group of patients that at 52 weeks had not hit SALT 20. They had not regrown their hair to hit below SALT 20. And they found that over the next year, by 104 weeks, 40% of those guys went on to grow their scalp hair. So if you're seeing eyebrow growth, eyelash growth, beard growth is not in this data, but I will extend it to that. If you're seeing places you don't want hair, these are all my female patients, like the only place I'm growing hair is on my legs, thank you very much, right? It is a sign that other things may be in your future and may be coming that you shouldn't stop the drug early. But 2 years is a really, really long time. Think about what you were doing 2 years ago. For eyebrows and eyelashes, you can see that they generally go faster. So for people that responded at week 52, you can see on the left, again, this starts at 52 weeks. So 70% of people on the 4 milligram, 60% on the 2 milligram, about the same in both groups grew eyebrows, which on the left, eyelashes on the right. And then this percentage not only was maintained, but continued to increase by week 104. So some patients only grow their scalp. Their eyebrows will often come a little bit later. And then if you stay on the medication and you regrow your hair, the maintenance is high. right? Meaning that if it works, it generally works pretty well for a long period of time. So if at 52 weeks it was working, it generally is working for 90% of patients at a year later. The real question, though, and something my patients always ask, is, well, how do I get off this medicine? And the challenge is that it doesn't appear as though you really can. So this is the top is people that, so these are all patients that were on 4 milligrams of baricitinib. The top is people who continued on 4 milligrams. The bottom is people who changed from 4 milligrams to 2 milligrams. So dose reduction meant about half the patients lost their hair, lost their response over the course of that year. If you go to zero, this data is not here, it'll be about 3/4 of people will lose their hair, will not be able to maintain their hair. So this is without them stepping down to another drug. Maybe if they were on minoxidil, maybe if there's something like that, you could maintain it. But the hard part about losing hair is that if I lose my hair and you put me back on baricitinib, we just saw how long it takes, but it doesn't take that long for my hair to get to the length that I want. Imagine if you're a woman or somebody with very long hair, that's the way you want your hair to look. You lose hair, it takes 8 months for the hair to start regrowing, then it takes another 2 years for it to catch up with the rest of your hair, right? This is not eczema where if it flares, a week later you start the medicine and a week after that you're starting to feel better. You have really an organic process where you have to stop the inflammation, allow the hair to regrow, and go from there. So the big question, what about side effects? This is the black box warning that is on all JAK inhibitors, okay? It's talking about malignancy, stroke, cardiovascular events. It scares the hell out of patients. This is data that comes as a general warning that is mostly based on tofacitinib, which is a JAK1/2 inhibitor, that was the first JAK inhibitor really commercially used, and used at higher doses, mostly in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. If you elevate the risk, if you elevate the dosing of these medications, you can induce venous thromboembolism with almost any of these drugs. The higher you go on the dose, the more likely you are to clot. We don't understand why. But the important part is to understand that at the doses that are being prescribed for dermatologic conditions, so which are generally lower, and in the patients that they're being prescribed to, for example, patients with alopecia areata do not have an elevated risk of stroke or cardiovascular events at baseline. That's the context in which you need to think about your patients. There's not, though, like a blood test or an evaluation or testing that you can do. There is some risk stratification that we can talk about. So how do you get started on these medications? Well, the medical history is key. You talk about malignancy risk. So if somebody has, let's say, I had a history of breast cancer, I've had this go on, I'm not very enthusiastic about starting these medications. Not because I necessarily think they're going to cause these cancers to come back, is that sometimes cancers come back and I don't know why, right? And I don't want to have, I'm not sure that from my perspective, this risk is worth it. If the patient is particularly motivated, it's worth the conversation with the oncologist. But I'd be very wary of even proposing these in this case. For clotting risk, you can do stratification. So if you are female, if you're smoking, if you're obese, if you have a personal family history, if you're on oral contraceptives, these are all risk factors. If you don't have any of these risk factors, green light, go for it. Doesn't mean there's no risk, but it means your risk is very, very low. If you have one or two or three of these risk factors, it'd be worth a conversation with the patient, it'd be worth a conversation with the patient's primary care doctor. You really have to engage in shared decision-making at that time. Pre-treatment vaccinations would be great. There is a slightly increased risk of zoster in these patients. If they're older, get them the zoster vaccine beforehand. A COVID vaccination, baricitinib actually seems to help COVID patients, but COVID vaccination, flu vaccination, pneumococcal vaccination, all the basic stuff. They can still mount responses to this based on preliminary data, so if you can't, you don't have to hold up the medications for this, but make sure you have that conversation and put them on those medications. For laboratory testing, we're probably testing way too much. We do tuberculosis and hepatitis testing up front. You can check CBCs and LFTs about a month afterwards, and then I check them at a month, I check them at 3 months and 6 months, and then if everything is fine and there, I check them every 6 months to a year afterwards. Lipids go up, it's unclear what if this matters, it's unclear what, if it makes a difference, are we treating a number, are we actually treating cardiovascular risk, it's unclear. That's something that will be addressed, I think, in the future as we have more data on these patients. So what's next for alopecia areata? More JAK inhibitors on the way. Ritlecitinib is a JAK3 TEC inhibitor. JAK3 has a specific sort of nature to it where it can bind, by binding JAK3, JAK3 is not expressed in the bone marrow. So the concept behind the JAK3 inhibition is that you can do the anti-inflammation, at least improvement of your alopecia areata, without having as many hematologic side effects. Now, looking at baricitinib, there's not that many hematologic side effects, but this would be a theoretical improvement for this. Deruxolitinib is a JAK1-2 inhibitor, so right, intellectually the same as baricitinib, but you can't think of them the same, as we just discussed. Deruxolitinib is dosed much more aggressively. It has, in the data so far, it works much better than baricitinib. But at the highest dose, it recently had some reported venous thromboembolism in the trial, and they had to remove the highest dose from the trial. It'll be very interesting to see when they come out with the, if they're able to make it to get FDA approval for their drug, how that will be received and what the safety profile will be. There may be a bit of a trade where you're trading a little bit of safety for a little bit more efficacy. There are several other drugs that are very different mechanisms that are in early trials. I think this is something that we'll be learning a lot more about over the next 3 to 5 years. So let me share with you the early ritlecitinib data. This is from the Lancet. I am showing you all the data for all the doses all at the same time. Basically, they did lots of different treatment regimens. What you need to take home from this is basically 40% of people at week 24, 30 to 40% of people at week 24, depending on the drug regimen they used. That's not apples to apples. Baricitinib outcomes were at 36 weeks. These outcomes are at 24 weeks. It probably is about the same as baricitinib if you look at it head to head. The question would be, will it be safer or work in different patient population than baricitinib, which I think will lead to its how well it's adopted. So how to think about AA in 2023? We have game-changing new therapies. Let's work with patients to see how we can help. We need to offer this to our patients. We have to offer it to them. It's the only game in town. If you know one drug, you know one drug. This is totally different from the way we were trained in psoriasis. You had to rethink this. Failing one JAK inhibitor doesn't mean you will fail another, even if they're the same, right? So I said JAK1-2 inhibitor, and then a JAK1-2 inhibitor for baricitinib and deruxolitinib. Some respond to one and the other, or vice versa. I know this from trials where flipping people between trials. Some people work in some trial, one trial, some people don't. JAK3 inhibitor, if I had a patient that had started on another drug and didn't work, I'd be totally fine taking them to ritlecitinib to see if that drug works for them. These drugs are fundamentally different. They're not as clean as we think they are, and people's metabolism and inflammatory states are different. You're gonna have to test and see. They're all gonna be slow. So that's one of the challenges of testing and seeing. The initial safety across these drugs is all good. It's all reassuring. Baricitinib, 9.5 years of data in humans so far across many diseases. Long-term safety, what happens at 20 years? Well, we'll have to see. So you have to have that discussion with your patients. So patient selection, risk modification, and education. Education for you to be patient, education for the patient to be patient. You have to wait, you have to see if it works. It's one thing to say, hey, this may work a long time. 9 months, a year, 2 years, people are growing out hair, right? So think about that. So at this point, I think what we have is shared decision making, where we have honest conversation with our patients. We select the right patients, we reduce the risk, we have to talk about them and say, look, I can't guarantee that these bad things are not gonna happen to you. I can't tell you what's gonna happen in 20 years, but I can guess as to what's going to happen, I know what's gonna happen in the short term. So are you willing to take that risk? Should we try this together and see if your hair grows? It very well will be that you may be on a JAK inhibitor for 20 years, because if you come off the medication, most likely your hair is gonna fall out. Or there may be a better drug that's coming in 3 to 5 years. You can try that differently. So that's the honest discussion of risks and benefits of treatment, including no treatment. If your patient is satisfied and happy with their lack of hair, there's no reason to encourage them to go down this route if they don't have to. Long-term research is critical to continue to monitor the space. So one last place to look, JAKs beyond alopecia areata. So as I said, they work across these range of medication, a range of diseases. They even work for inflammatory diseases that we may not quite understand what's causing them. One of these conditions is lichen planopilaris. So this is a case report for treatment of lichen planopilaris. You can see the inflammation on the left. You can see the red dots in this patient's area. You can see the it's called the swarm of bees, the classic perifollicular inflammation on the right from the biopsy in these patients. And this patient was started on 4 milligrams of baricitinib. And then over time, you can see this is a dermoscopy image. The inflammation went from A to B to C, where you see that white scarring. And then clinically, the patient went to D, which is not awesome, right? Because there's a lot of scarring, but the redness is not there anymore, right? The inflammation is gone. So this has been recreated as a study of 12 patients with a combination of either frontoprolapsing alopecia or lichen planopilaris in Australia. About 7 of them did better with this. 5 either didn't respond or got worse. 7 of them did better. They use high doses. They use 6 milligrams, 9 milligrams sometimes, so higher doses of baricitinib. It may not be that baricitinib is potent enough for some of these patients, but somebody in the JAK family, it may be a future utility of this. So even though we don't understand why or what exactly is happening in lichen planar pilaris, the broad reach of JAK inhibitors is critical. So conclusion, in the words of Mogutu, hair loss is so hot right now, is going to go from something that hopefully we are all frustrated to see on our schedule, something that we have the tools and tricks and abilities to treat. And the future is bright. So I mean, this is a major challenge for patients. Hopefully better treatments are on the way. We need to make the best use of what we have now. I would not oversell these medications in terms of efficacy. I would not oversell these medications in terms of side effects. The way to think about these medications intellectually, they're kind of like Enbrel. They're the earliest medications. They're a total game changer. They're revolutionary for these patients. They're not perfect. They're not the IL-3 inhibitor, 23 inhibitors yet. So over time, hopefully, we'll have better efficacy, better understanding, better data for these medications. But we should get on board and use what we have now. So you need to learn about new treatments, and we need to learn about them. You got to do your homework. You got to do them specifically. So you can't be like, I'm going to learn about classes. Classes are not going to be as useful here. Every medication is going to be a little bit different, particularly on the efficacy and safety, both on efficacy and safety profiles. And finally, setting expectations, being honest about potential risk rewards is the key. And it'll establish a healthy relationship with your patient that you can, if the drug works, that's awesome. If the drug doesn't work, then you can continue to coach them along their hair loss journey. Thank you very much, guys. I'm happy to take any questions. First question, can you use oral minoxidil and oral spironolactone together? Absolutely. You should use them together. They work awesome together, and actually the oral spironolactone seems to reduce, in theory, some of the facial hypertrichosis that you can get with oral minoxidil in women. So if patients are willing to accept it, I would definitely use them. They work different mechanisms, and together they work better than either one alone. How long do you wait to increase the oral minoxidil dose? This is an awesome question. I do it not in a very scientific way. I do it based on how annoyed the patient is that their hair is or is not growing, right? And how concerned they are about hypertrichosis. So I think it takes about 6 months. Between 3 and 6 months, you can really begin to see an improvement. It's hard, right? Often, like for women with longer hair in particular, you can't see the improvement because they want volume, right? They want their ponytail to be thicker. Well, if I'm growing hair from here, it takes a year and a half before it gets out into a ponytail, right? But you can show them, or they're having small regrowths here, they're having small regrowths in those areas. What Dr. Madhujan was talking about, serial photography, it can be super useful. So if I have somebody that wants to be aggressive, I will start them either at the higher dose or say, take this for a month. If you're not having problems, then increase to, let's say, from 1.25 to 2.5, right? For men, it's a little bit more free. It doesn't, 5 milligrams would be fine if they want to do it. So either take baby steps or go full, depending on what the patient wants. If I have not seen the improvement we want by 6 months, I will go up. If the patient wants it anywhere along that pathway, I will take them up. Dosing for dupilumab for AA is the same as atopic dermatitis. So I'm not sure if that's actually the right dosing because we don't have any specific trials in this. There's some trials where they use they're based on the pharmacokinetics of dupilumab in AD, so they dose it the same way. This is not a drug you're going to be able to get approved on the AA side. You're going to have to use an AD. You've got to be generous with your description of their AD to help it get over the prior authorization line. Do you believe minoxidil will become first line for alopecia areata? Currently, we are taught steroids in our first line in PA school curriculums. I'm hoping that we have better topicals that are neither minoxidil nor steroids that can do that. There's actually a couple of very promising ones that have early phase 2 and some phase 3 data that may really change how we do this. But until then, I do think that topical or oral minoxidil is probably more efficacious than topical steroids. What you are taught in PA school is not different than what I was taught in medical school or in residency, and what, again, a third to 40% of your colleagues are already doing, which is to give topical steroids straight up. I just don't think that those are very useful. And there is some truth that, you know, busy hands are happy hands, right? You give somebody something to do, but I'm hoping that we can bend the curve in a different way. Do you have any experience or results of applying topical ruxolitinib and concomitantly taking baricitinib for alopecia areata? Well, that's a fantastic question. Topical ruxolitinib failed alopecia areata trials for the scalp. It may have some role in kids, but it doesn't penetrate deep enough. The same thing that gives your topical ruxolitinib safety is the same thing that makes it not work here. It doesn't go deep into the skin. It's not absorbed. So in my mind, there's not a very much of a role for topical ruxolitinib in most patients in alopecia areata. I have seen patients that either have compounded topical tofacitinib or topical ruxolitinib where some of them get a little bit better, but it's by no means highly efficacious. And then particularly as your hair starts regrowing, it can't get down the hair follicle. So the problem is you need continued therapy and the mechanics of it are challenging. There's a little bit different for eyebrows and eyelashes where it is safe to put ruxolitinib on your eyelid, it's safe to put ruxolitinib on your eyebrows. For those populations, for people with beard alopecia, that population, for children, those are three or four different populations that topical ruxolitinib, either solo or in combination, may be a benefit. I don't think there would be any safety issue of combining the two together. How long do I wait to increase aluminum dose, so the baricitinib dose? So I am not a very patient guy, and I actually start exclusively with a high dose. The 2 milligram dose works slowly. When it works, it takes fewer patients respond to it. And if I had to wait a month and then see the results then change, I would be happy starting with the 2. But in reality, if I'm waiting 6 to 9 months, I don't want to wait 6 to 9 months and then say, man, let's go take you from 2 to 4 at that point, right? So what I do is I start everybody on 4, which is a little bit different than I think how it's certainly taught, but that's my general approach. And then if they regrow their hair, I have that conversation, understanding that 30% of them will lose hair, right? Do you want to try going down to 2 milligrams? Some patients are like, that is awesome, I absolutely want to try coming down. Other patients are like, I would rather not. And again, I think there's no safety, although, you know, intellectually you don't want to be on more medication than you need to, there's absolutely no data to suggest any difference in safety profile other than perhaps slightly increased risk of acne in the 4 milligram dose. So I generally go fully for that. Rarely insurance will have me start at the 2 milligram dose. If I do that, I will do that for 3 months, and if I haven't seen any motion, I'll move to 4 milligram dose. Do I have any experience with PRP? I do have experience with PRP. I feel PRP works sometimes, and it doesn't work a lot of the time. And I think that we really think about the times it works, and we really ignore the times it doesn't work. And because it's expensive, it's painful to do, and given the fact that the consistency of response is not there, I generally discourage my patients from doing it because I feel that, you know, $20 for 90 days of minoxidil is much, much more likely across many more people to have more efficacy than a $900 PRP treatment that you have to do, you know, 3 to 6 times in a row. I have nothing against PRP. If a patient very much wants to do it, we offer it. I don't do it personally, but we offer it at our practice, and I refer those patients. But it's not something that I'm generally particularly excited about because we have other options. Based on what you know about alopecia areata, how would you guess a pan-JAK, tofacitinib, for example, would perform versus a selective JAK, baricitinib, for example? Is selectivity and specificity key here? I don't think it's selectivity. I think actually you're going to have great data from, there's a lot of reports of JAK1 inhibitors doing great, and they're highly selective, and they work great. I think the question is, what dose are you willing to put patients at? So the higher the dose, the better the efficacy of the drug. I think tofacitinib at 5 milligrams twice a day is a slightly higher, more potent amount of this medication to take than baricitinib 2 or 4 milligrams once daily. So I think if you did a head-to-head at 5 milligrams twice a day, tofacitinib will work better across a population. The difference is that you are probably trading risk for that, and we don't know what that risk is because those studies haven't been formally done. So if you had a patient that didn't respond to baricitinib, they really wanted to try tofacitinib, particularly now that tofacitinib is coming off patent, it would be a reasonable consideration and idea to do. The hard part is that, remember, that black box warning largely comes from tofacitinib, and we don't really know in this population how to balance the risk and benefit there. So something that we have to, do shared decision making with. I use both of these drugs in my clinical practice, but I start with the one we have more data for, baricitinib. All right, guys, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.